Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. So goes the hymn we love to sing. It all sounds so wonderfully comforting and cozy. But how does grace save a wretch like Jacob? How does the grace of God come and save a wretch like Jacob? We sang, how can it be, that God should save a soul like me? And rightly we ought to, that truth ought to resonate in our hearts because none of us have a claim on God. God will be no man's debtor. God's not obligated to save us. God's not obligated to save anyone. And when we come to that great text in Romans chapter 9, Jacob have I loved, but Esau I have hated. Commentators, and a good number of good commentators have agreed that the marvel is not so much that God, that it's recorded that God hated Esau, but the marvel of all marvels is that God would love a man like Jacob. And that's what the hymn writer was getting at, that God would love any of us, that God would set His electing love on any of us, that God would be pleased to save any of us, is an amazing thing. But how did God save this man named Jacob, this man whose name means deceiver, cheat, supplanter? I wonder what his parents were thinking when they gave him that name. Pretty consistent with who he was, right? A cheater, a schemer, a conniver, a deceiver. And yet God, in mercy and in grace, comes to this man and wrestles this man, as it were, to the mat. And we see this incredible picture of relentless grace, the grace of God that would not be deterred, would not be denied, would not give up on this man named Jacob. I want to ask a couple of questions to get us into this text. In my Sunday school this past year, we gave somewhere between 12 and 15 weeks to a study of two of the three patriarchs. We'd studied Abraham some years back, and we concentrated our attention on those portions in Genesis that dealt with Isaac and Jacob. So it's pretty challenging tonight to condense what I want to say about Jacob to one message, but that's my intention tonight. But let's ask a couple of questions, because again, Romans chapter 9 says, Jacob have I loved. Why? Why did God love him? And the answer in the context of Romans 9 is because God was pleased to love him. We have no other explanation. It certainly wasn't because of anything in Jacob. It's a good thing God decided to love him before he came into this world, before he had done anything good or bad. Because as we study this man's life, he earns a fair number of demerits that in human terms would have disqualified him from any kind of favor, let alone divine favor. Why did God love him? Because it pleased God to do so. When did he love him? When did God love him? Well, God determined to love him in eternity past. That's why we sang tonight some hymns that remind us of that great truth. Before he was born, before he had done anything good or bad, God had determined that he was going to love that man and love that man salvifically. That's when he loved him. But then the more important question, and the question that will occupy our time tonight, is how did he love him? How did God love him? And I want to suggest three things and then look at the text here in Genesis 32. How did God love Jacob? Well, he loved him relentlessly. Relentlessly. Dogged his steps all his earthly sojourn. Loved him in spite of himself. Loved him when he was a boy in the home. Loved him when he was a fugitive on the run from his brother. Loved him when he was with his uncle Laban. Loved him his entire life. He loved him discriminately. He loved him in a way that he did not love his brother Esau. In fact, again, we looked last night, we won't rehearse that, but the text tells us Esau, God hated. He loved Jacob discriminately. And again, he loved him redemptively. He loved him redemptively. I want you to look with me in Genesis 32. I want us to consider this text, and as we do, we're going to be tracing some word pictures that we find in the latter half of the chapter, and there's four of them I want to give to you. The first one is, we see a man who's trembling, a man overcome with fear. But that word picture of trembling. Secondly, the word picture of wrestling. Third, clinging. And fourth, limping. And those word pictures will guide us as we just do a quick overview of the life of Jacob as it's recorded for us here in chapter 32. There are nine chapters in sacred scripture that are given to give us the account of Jacob's life. And that's significant, very significant. There's so much we can learn about God's dealings with sinners, of which Jacob was indeed one. Aren't you glad tonight that God delights to write with crooked sticks? Because if there ever was a crooked stick, it was Jacob. Right? Crooked man. As we come to chapter 32, you've heard the expression between a rock and a hard place. That's where we find Jacob, as the opening verse begins. So Jacob went on his way, and the angel of God met him. Well, went on his way from where? He went on his way from an encounter with his uncle Laban. He'd served his uncle for 20 years, 7 years for what he thought was to be Rachel, and the deceiver was deceived by his uncle. He was one-upped by his uncle. And instead of getting Rachel for 7 years of labor, he got Leah. And he so loved Rachel, he was willing to work 7 more years, in which he did. But after 14 years, all he had to show for his labor was 2 wives. And he worked for this man another 7 years. And as he did, God blessed him and he accumulated a great wealth. But things turned in Laban's countenance toward him. Laban was smart enough to acknowledge, to even see, but and to acknowledge to Jacob, when Jacob said and hinted that he was going to leave, Laban said, I have come to learn by experience that God has blessed me because of you. So it was advantageous for Laban, not for Jacob to leave, because as long as Jacob was there, the blessing of God was on Jacob, despite the man he was. And Uncle Laban was the great beneficiary of this blessing that spilled out into his life. But God came to him, came to Jacob as he was in the field. In chapter 31, we have these words. Verse 11, then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, Jacob. And I said, here I am. And he said, lift your eyes now and see all the rams which leap on the flocks that are streaked, speckled, and gray spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. Verse 13, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar on where you and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land and return to the land of your family. You remember the story, how he had cheated his brother out of the birthright, how Esau was the father's favorite, Isaac's favorite. Rebekah saw that, and she favored Jacob. She loved Jacob. And in cooperation with his mother, he connived and deceived his father, cheated his brother out of the birthright. And Esau, when discovering that, threatened that he was going to kill his brother. And that threat caused Jacob to flee to Haran, to Uncle Laban's, and he's been there 20 years. The consequences of sin. God had already told the parents that the older was going to serve the younger. God had already decreed that. They didn't need to cheat and scheme to make that happen. God had already determined it was going to happen. And because of his ways, he was paying a terrible price, because he was estranged not only from his brother, but because of that estrangement was nowhere to be his aging parents. In fact, his mother said, you go to Uncle Laban, and when Esau's temper cools down and he no longer is a threat, I will call for you and you can come home. Well, that call never came. 20 years went by. That call never came. When he left home, he never saw his mother again. But he left in the middle of the night because he knew that Uncle Laban was not going to let him go. So he gathered up his wives and his servants and his family and all of his belongings, and they left under the shroud of darkness. And after a 3-day journey, Laban discovered and he pursued them and he came on their encampment. And I think Laban had evil intentions. And God intervened and God protected him. But Laban didn't trust Jacob, and Jacob didn't trust Laban. And they entered into an agreement, set a stone, a pile of stones, that neither would cross over. So here he was, between a rock, a literal pile of rocks, and a hard place. Laban to his back, and his brother in front. And 20 years of estrangement was going to be, have to be confronted. And how God, in mercy and in kindness, comes to Jacob. In that context, verse 1 again, Jacob went on his way and the angels of God met him. The angels of God met him. What a tremendous encouragement that had to be. Why did God, in mercy, reveal himself in this way? He was trying to get a message across to this man that he should trust in the unseen forces of God and trust that God would protect him in the face of perceived danger with his brother, just as God had protected him all these years. A mercy of God to reveal himself to him in this way. As he has left Uncle Laban and he's journeying, I think as he made his way away from the encampment, his mind was on Laban, knowing full well that in the passing of time, his departure would be discovered, not knowing the consequences of that, So he's thinking about Laban. He's thinking about what's coming. But now that that's passed, and he is in obedience to God, and he's going back to the promised land, his mind now is on his brother, Esau. And that's emphasized in this chapter, the first 21 verses. 9 times you see Esau's name mentioned. In verse 3, and in verse 4, and in verse 6, and in verse 8, and in verse 11, and in verse 13, and verse 17, and verse 18, and in verse 19. And it's as though each time his foot hit the dirt in the wilderness, the echo of his brother's name, Esau, 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 Esau. And it began to control him. 20 years of unresolved conflict with his brother was all going to come to a head. And we know what kind of a man he is. Well, he's not short on plans. So he goes in to exercise a plan. Verse 3, Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother in the land of Seir in the country of Edom. And he took the position. When you come across him and he inquires who you are, you tell him you are a servant of Jacob and that Jacob is Esau's Lord. Well, that's a new one. That's a new one. He sent gifts, livestock. For what reason? To appease his brother. But what happened? Very quickly, the messenger returned and said, "On our way, we encountered your brother Esau. And he's on his way to meet you with 400 men. We're not left to wonder what interpretation Jacob had with that news, because the text tells us he believed that Esau was on his way to exact revenge for cheating him out of his birthright 20 years earlier. He thought, Esau's coming, payday's here. So he divides his family into two companies with the thought, well, Jacob can't attack both companies at the same time, and if he attacks one, the other may escape. Now, he didn't know that Esau is not of that mind. He's not coming in hatred. He's not coming in vengeance. But it's, again, I think a mercy of God that he doesn't know that. Because God is dealing with this man. God is backing this man in a corner. God is stripping away everything he had depended upon. And God is going to overcome this man with relentless grace. The first word that I drew to your attention was trembling, and that really describes Jacob. Verse 7, Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him in the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. And he said, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the other company which is left will escape. Then Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you. It's interesting that we have this prayer recorded. Jacob was not a praying man. He was not a praying man. There are no other prayers recorded earlier about him. But it's amazing what fear will do to a man. He's turning in the right direction. He's looking up. He's looking to God. And that's a good thing. And his posture's correct. Verse 10, I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies of all the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. He's taken inventory and he realizes, when I left 20 years ago, all I had was a shirt on my back. And he was going to Haran looking for a wife, like his father's servant had gone looking for Isaac's wife. You remember. But the servant went, Abraham's servant went with all kinds of gifts that would commend him. And here, Jacob was traveling the same path. And he didn't have any gifts. All he had was a shirt on his back. And when he showed up, well, when you read the text, you wonder if he's ever going to make it. The danger he was in, no supplies. But he's grateful. He is rehearsing in his own mind. I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I've become two companies. And then his prayer. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. There he is. Alone. In the desert. The blackness of night. And he's a trembling man. He's a fearful man. He's a restless man as well. Notice with me in verse 22. Wouldn't surprise us that he didn't sleep well that night. He arose that night and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and he crossed over the ford of Jabbok. He took them, sent them over the brook, and sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone. He was left alone. I think God had him where God wanted him to be. He needed to be alone. You get this picture in your mind. Here's a trembling, fearful man. He's taken inventory of his life. All that he's accumulated in 20 years is across the river. And here he is, all by himself, alone in the dark. And a hand reaches out and touches him. Is it a robber? Here to take advantage of him and take the only thing he has left? Is it an assassin sent by Esau to kill him in the night? No, we move from the word picture of trembling to the word picture of wrestling. Verse 24, Jacob was left alone and a man, capital M, wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Until the breaking of day. A man. As we read the encounter, all commentators agree that this is a picture of the pre-incarnate Christ, a manifestation of the second person of the Trinity, come to wrestle with Jacob. What's interesting is what the text tells us. A man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. It's important to understand what's being said here. It's not that Jacob wrestled with the man. It's rather the man wrestled with Jacob. And it's surprising to me that I read a number of good commentators who, in my opinion, missed the point here. We must not think that this passage is primarily an encouragement to what we would call prevailing prayer. It's not that Jacob is seeking God to wrestle with him. It is God who comes to wrestle with Jacob. God comes. God comes and takes initiative to deal with this man. And that's the way it always is in salvation. God's the initiator. Men aren't looking for God. But thank God, God's on the hunt for sinners. And He's looking for sinners. And He is going to prevail over sinners like He does Jacob. So God comes to wrestle with Jacob, and the question is, for what purpose? Why has God come to wrestle with Jacob? Well, I think it is to bring Jacob to a sense of his nothingness, to cause him to see what a poor, helpless, and worthless creature he was, to teach us through him the important lesson that this is the way God comes to all sinners. It's an astounding account. It says, the man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. We don't know how late into the night this encounter took place, but the indications seems to be that there were a good part of the night that this wrestling went on. A long time. And I don't know how Jacob managed to keep up the struggle that long. But I think it tells us something about the stubbornness and the rebellion that lies within the human heart, that it doesn't die easy. It doesn't die quickly. God persevered with Jacob. You see, God never loses. He is the sovereign God. Jacob wasn't going to win here. I wonder when it dawned on him. Better run the white flag up the pole. Better give it up. Better submit. Better surrender. And if we're smart, we'll recognize the earlier we submit, the better. We're not going to win. If you're here tonight, you're in rebellion toward God. Understand what a foolish posture you have assumed. Who are you struggling with? Who are you battling with? Who are you at war with? You're at war with God Almighty. You won't win. You will not win. And His purpose is to pursue you relentlessly until He subdues you. So why extend the misery? Why pay any greater price than you've already paid? Surrender. Surrender. And as you surrender, live. Live. You won't die. You won't be consumed. You'll know life in a way you've never known it before. It's amazing how the devil will tell somebody, the worst thing you can do is submit to him. The worst thing you can do is surrender your life. He'll ruin your life. The devil, he's always attacking the character of God, isn't he? Attacking his motives, imputing ill to God. Well, I think we can relate here, can't we, to Jacob? Because a good many of us, if not most of us, have had God put our life out of joint. We've had our plans dislocated and derailed. We were trying to do something contrary to God's will. And suddenly, out of the blue, God in providence used sickness or loss of a job or some other providence to hinder us in what we were determined to do. And He did all of that for our good. We didn't see it at the time. But God is a God of relentless grace and marvelous mercy. But not only trembling and not only wrestling, but I want you to see, in the third place, we see Jacob clinging to the one who has triumphed over him. Verse 26, he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Jacob was going to cling to Christ. That's the best advice I can give any sinner. Cling to Christ. Why? Because there's no other name given among men whereby we may be saved. If you're going to be saved, you're going to be saved by Christ. And when you know that, as a sinner, you're going to cling to Him. You're going to hold on to Him. And you're not going to want to let Him go. You see, the change has now taken place. We see a totally different Jacob. Jacob is wrestling in his own strength for his own way initially, and now his strength is broken, and he's simply clinging to Christ for His blessing. We don't like to be there. There's something about our human nature. We like a position of perceived strength. We don't like sickness. We don't like weakness. We don't like disability, do we? And yet, it's those very things that put us in a place of strength. Because when we are weak, He is strong. As long as we're relying upon ourselves, as long as we're trusting ourselves, we will not trust Him. Because the trust that's demanded is an exclusive trust. Not a little bit of me and a little bit of Him, but a denouncing of me, a denouncing of all my reliance on anything about me, and a complete giving myself to Him. That's the only thing that will save a man. But we have here in Jacob a picture of a man surrendered to the will of God. It's a picture of faith. And Charles Wesley expressed that clinging nature of faith in one of his hymns, "Jesus, Lover of My Soul," when he wrote, "Other refuge have I none, hangs my helpless soul on Thee. Leave me not alone, still support and comfort me. All my trust on Thee is stayed, all my help from Thee I bring," said Wesley. We need the determination and the strength of faith to hang helpless on Christ. It's a paradox, isn't it? To hang helpless on Christ. Has God brought you to that place tonight? If you're going to make it to glory, you're going to make it to heaven, you're going to make it because you're clinging to Christ. You know that? That's your posture? That's the way you move through life? And if you are doing that tonight, it's because God has wrought that work of grace in you. He's shown you that Christ is precious. He's shown you that Christ is the way. He is the way, the truth and the life. There is no other way but Him. And when you know that, you can't help but cling to Him. You can't help but cling to Him. But there's one more word picture here that concludes this chapter, and it's the word picture of limping. Limping. You know, before this encounter, his name was Jacob. And Jesus extracted a confession out of him when he said, "What's your name?" He knew what his name was, but he wanted to hear Jacob acknowledge his name. And with the speaking of his name, he was revealing his character. He was revealing who he'd been and how he'd lived his life. "What is your name?" he said, "Jacob." He knew what that name meant. He knew by saying Jacob, he meant cheater, deceiver, conniver, supplanter. But he's not that anymore. And to give evidence of that, he said, that is, Christ said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "Why is it that you ask about my name?" I love that. I love that. Isn't it obvious? You're asking my name? And he blessed them there. So Jacob called the name of the place Peniel. He knew who he was wrestling with. He says, "For I have seen" what? "God. I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." And just as he crossed over Peniel, the sun rose on him, and he limped on his hip. He limped on his hip. Interesting picture, isn't it? I think that limp was a gracious bestowment of God upon him. I think there's irony here. There's irony here. What do I mean by that? Well, with men, Jacob had contended successfully. He had contended with his brother Esau. He had contended with Uncle Laban. He had contended with his mother and father. And there was the apparent of success. He had gotten what he was after. And yet, at the same time, he was the loser. He cheated Esau of the blessing, but he lost Esau's goodwill. He outwitted his blind and ailing father, but he lost his relationship with his parents. However, in his battle with God, Jacob suffers a reversal of his fortunes, which is actually his victory. He loses his wrestling match with God. God touches his hip and he is permanently wounded. But his loss becomes his victory. At last, Jacob surrenders himself. And it's again the paradox of the Christian life. We gain by losing. We win by losing. And he's now able to go on in new strength as God's man. Those who oppose us in the world, you talk to people and often, I mean, maybe not often, but there's been a time or two where someone has said to me, "Well, your Christianity is for weak people. Your Christianity is a crutch. It may work for you, but it's only for weak people." What do you say to that? What do you say to that? I won't argue with you on that. It is for weak people. It is for weak people. You see, in the world's eyes, we are cripples. We're cripples. But don't let the world define what's success and what is failure. Because the world's got it upside down, doesn't it? The world has it upside down. God's strength is made perfect in our weakness. And it is when we appear the weakest that we are the strongest. And that's why Paul could say that he gloried in infirmities and in weaknesses. Why? Because he'd learned the secret that when he was weak, then he was strong. God's grace was manifest in his life. This is a great picture of how God relentlessly pursued this man, Jacob. And the more you know about Jacob's life, the more marvel it is that God would love a man like this. But because God loved a man like this, and here's the evidence of God loving a man like this, that there's hope for us. Right? There's hope for us because we can see ourselves in Jacob. We're like him. We're like him in our sinfulness. But what a God of great grace, a God of relentless grace. We're going to sing here in a minute Chris Anderson's wonderful hymn, "We've Come to Love Here." "Relentless love embraced my soul in ages past." That would be, could be, Jacob's testimony. What kind of love in ages past? Love undeserved, unknown, yet deep and vast. God set his love on me in spite of me. Salvation's work is his from first to last. Think about Jacob in relationship to the second stanza. "Relentless love pursued my heart, though I would hide." Well, if there's anything that would define and describe this man Jacob, is he was a refuge. He was on the run. And when circumstances heated up, he was out of there. He was out of there. Whether it was home or whether it was Uncle Laban's. "Relentless love pursued my heart, though I would hide. Was unreturned, yet undeterred by pride. Till by a grace unsought, my rebel soul was caught. Redeemed by love that would not be denied." That could be Jacob's testimony, couldn't it? That's what we're discovering in this man. Well, let's rejoice together. We're going to sing that in a moment. Let me have a word of prayer with you. Father, your grace truly is amazing. May we never get over the fact of its amazement. Would you impress deeply upon our hearts what a debt of gratitude we owe to you? We thank you, our God, for such mercy, such grace, not only extended to the man that we've studied tonight, Jacob, but to sinners like ourselves. Help us to live for your glory. Help us to live as one who's been set free, rescued from the penalty of sin and is being rescued ongoingly from the power of sin and will one day forever be rescued, delivered from the very presence of sin itself. Thank you for giving us Christ. Thank you for making him precious to us. Thank you for giving us faith to believe on him. Thank you for the gift of repentance that has caused us to turn away from sin and its allurement and to embrace Christ, yea, cling to him. Help us to recommit ourselves to that very notion tonight. Leaving this place, knowing that we are sinners saved by grace, we limp, we halt, we're weak, and yet we're clinging to Christ. And because we are the envy of the world. Seal this word to our hearts, we pray. For our good and for Jesus' sake, we ask. Amen.